Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast Network. We turn 50 episodes old today. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. To celebrate our milestone, we are honored to have with us a very special guest, the Admiral of the Pitcherless Fleet and creator of The List, Mr. Nick Pollock. On this episode, we talk about the Dugout Study Hall origin story, Nick's approach to hitters, his favorite pitching stats, how to evaluate pitchers on the move, and so much more. But before we get to all of that, Nick, welcome.
What is happening? This is so much fun to be able to jump on these podcasts with you guys, and you're on episode 50 now.
Yeah.
That is amazing. You should be so proud of that. And I'm excited because if you bring me on a podcast, that means I just get to talk about pitching for a long time. And that's my favorite thing to do.
We're not going to ask you about hitting at all. I have no plans whatsoever to put you on the spot to talk about hitters. Alexander, what's keeping you busy these days?
Mostly thinking about hitters. not terribly a lot. I feel like I spent a whole lot of time recently trying to figure out what's going on in the not Major League Baseball world. I've never really been a person who cares that much about prospects, but I joined the Prospects Live Patreon, and I've been reading a lot of their content and just anything else I can consume. So a lot of that stuff mostly.
It's fantastic. So Nick, we are 50, like you said. We had to bring you on. We haven't had you on yet, and you made a point of making sure we knew that at our PitchCon presentation. And so there was no better way to fix two wrongs at the same time than to bring you on for Dugout Study Hall turning 50. And as a celebration, what I would like to know, I don't know if Alexander cares about this at all, but I'm going to ask anyway, is the origin story of our own podcast, because we were paired separate from each other and put together in this harmonious partnership. And I have never heard that story. So you're going to have to give us the skinny on the origin story of Dugout Study Hall.
Oh, man. Well, there isn't much to it. Trevor Huth and I decided, everybody that wanted to jump into podcasts, that there are a lot of people. It's really a blessing in that way that we have so many staffers that were interested in it. We set a high bar of saying, all right, you have to sound this way. You have to record a sample, and we just kind of threw people together randomly. And to us, in many, there are many qualities that make a good podcast, but at its heart, you have to have the host, and then you have to have the color, right? And we felt that, Matt, you were an amazing host, and you even said inside of your thing, I do not want to be the guy for answers.
I did. I was it's like, you're barking up the wrong tree if you want me to say really, really super smart things about baseball.
Exactly. And who is smarter than Alexander Chase to pair you with? And we felt this would be this perfect match. Chase, you were saying, I want to talk about intricacies of stats and really teach people about and really go into all of that stuff. Well, Matt, you were like, I don't know stuff, so I want to be paired with someone that knows a lot of stuff and they can teach me. I was like, oh, well, all right, let's go and do that. And we shoved you two together, and we both really liked your samples. And voila, Dugout Study Hall was born, and we're all so much better for it.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that last part, but we were definitely born for sure. Hey, Alexander, do you remember how long it took for us to come up with the name? It felt forever, right?
It was a couple weeks of DM each other, not even that good of suggestions for the most part.
Yeah, right. Yeah. How about this? No. How about that? No. So anyway,
it's really hard to come up with a good name. I mean, Fast and I are launching our next one called the Nick and Alex Baseball Show because we couldn't think of a better name.
But when you think of one, and then you type it in, somebody else clever too, right? You don't want to be 2.0.
Exactly.
So it's hard.
Now, I have a question for you guys. You changed your logo. How did that come to be?
I think that was me deciding that I was sick of the old one and doing it and then being like, hey, are you cool with this? And which font do you want? And Alexander being yeah, that works. That's fine. I like this one.
All right.
I'm pretty sure that's how it went down. It was not much more complicated than that.
Well, there you go. I mean, it looks great. I dug the old one, too. I thought that was a good one as well.
It worked. It was fine. I didn't hate
both
it.
Are good.
A change can be good sometimes.
Yeah, I totally get that. But what are we learning about today, guys?
Well, before we jump into like the crux of what we're going to talk about, which is obviously picking your brain about pitching, because we would be fools not to do that. What I want to know before we do any of this is how the pitching guru prepping for all of these drafts that you're doing.
Do not call me the pitching guru. Oh, no.
Are you afraid it's going to catch on?
Well, it's just the guru. I just feel like, I don't know. There's this understanding of, yes, come to me. Give me your questions. I'll give you enlightenment kind of idea. And I'm like, I don't know. Fair we don't enough. Know this stuff.
I won't tell you the pitcher oracle then. What I want to know, though, is obviously, in all seriousness, pitching is what you primarily focus your energy on. And you know a lot of stuff about a lot of pitchers really deep into the pitching pool. But you're in drafts, you're in industry drafts, you're in expert leagues, and you can't just draft pitchers. As we found out when I tried to tweet out my article and everybody got confused thinking that you were suggesting that you shouldn't draft a pitcher in the first 15 rounds.
Oh, so. Yeah. I thought that was a great article, and I wasn't confused at all. I thought that was a really cool piece that you did.
Well, thank you. I didn't bring it up for that, but I appreciate it. I want to know how you prep for the hitters, since you spend so much of your time and energy on pitching. What is it that you look for when you prep for hitters?
Yeah, I just listen to other people. That's what I do. Now, I mean, for the most part, I'm trying to think about my process right now. I've already established it. I'm like, what I do is I make my decisions and then I just kind of lean on those and then don't think about it again. But for me, it's dependability. I generally won't chase the new thing a lot, because I think hitters are, I mean, it's like this with pitchers. At least I understand what made them that way. Mm-hmm. A lot more, and the variability a lot of, especially guys with like higher strikeout rates or something like that, like are they going to still perform the same fashion? I obviously using hard contact percentage is a good thing. And by the way, Alex, I don't know if you know, but it is hard contact percentage on the player pages now. It is not HH over PA.
This was a
request from you.
I'm so touched that I've had.
It is live on the site.
I should note, I've definitely had more than a few people that like I play with in leagues who like now are like snapping up all of the guys that I like as a result of this, and it's like already starting to backfire. I'm sure you're familiar with how this works.
No, I am not, because all my friends, but I've known you since like fifth grade, man. Like, you're just Nick, you know, and they don't respect it at all, and which is great because then I win the league. But no, with hitters, there are obviously a lot of different ways to go. At the end of the day, it's more about dependability and not trying to do too much. Because of how I draft, it's more about just, I'm just have a good offense. I don't need to necessarily hit all the extra things because I'm already overpaying for hitters in the first place. And then I make up my ground in pitching and season and everything. That's just my bread and butter that has worked for a while. So it's nothing exciting, honestly. It's just like, is this dependable? I mean, at times I will obviously go into swing approach changes. Like, are they reducing their O swing? Are they swinging more in the zone? Are they pulling more? Are they, you know, obviously, walk rates and strikeout rates are always great. All those little things, of course, help massively. Then what is the batted ball profile like? Actual, you know, barrel percentage per plate appearance, all that fun stuff. Always over plate appearance.
Always.
But there is use in understanding it on the batted ball level, just to, if you've separated the two already. But that's generally my approach with it. I find myself doing everything I can to avoid finding an infielder in season, especially a second base or shortstop. So I will make sure that outfielders are more open. I find it easier to find a random outfielder because there's just more of them. And you just go, okay, I'll take a chance on this guy. And it works out a lot. You know, I'm not going to act like I know everything about hitting in season. I'll probably just, you know, read everything that Chase puts out. That's about it. So that's really my hitting approach. I have to do it too, like everybody else. I certainly downplay it. I spend my time, you know, doing it. But I don't know. I just kind of overpay for it and live with that.
Alexander, what's your thoughts on all this, on the process and all that?
Obviously, I have to give it a seal of approval. I'm kidding. one of the things it reminds me of is you ever heard the bit about like tiny town with like two barbershops? You know, like you want to go trust the guy with the bad haircut rather than the guy with the good haircut whenever, you know, it's like, yeah, you can't cut your own hair to a degree. And so you got to go find whoever else you can trust. And I tend to find the people who just focus on what they can do and leave other things to other people are often people who just kind of like, and one, get to do a lot more of the weird niche fun stuff that I'm most excited about.
Oh, yeah.
And two, like, as a result, often end up having a different approach to how they want to take in other people's information, because like, I don't know, like, I'm not going to try to step on your toes to figure out who has a good cutter or anything like that. It's just, or like who has repeatable mechanics or anything like that. Cause like, that's just not what I care about being right about ever. Cause someone else has already done that better than me for sure. I always appreciate people who have found their niche and then can just like go after other people's stuff and say, hey, I like this thing for X reason. That's not trying to pat myself on the back here or anything like that. But like, you know, I find that there's a lot of other people I follow who that's their way of doing things. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I will say the joke about PitcherList is that I write about starting pitchers and I hired 175 staffers to write about everything else. Right. So if I can't find, you know, my hitters through those staff members, then what am I doing?
Sounds like you can't find writers who can write about hitting either if you have to draft 175 of them.
Oh, no. All right, guys. It's been a fun Touché. Run.
Right. It's all over. All right. Let's move into our numbers of the week segment and get into your bread and butter there, Nick. And that is pitching. When you are doing your deep dives, when you're looking at what separates a pitcher, whether it's somebody who you're thinking might be the fifth starter, or whether it's who do I want to take in early in drafts, who do I want to be my SP1, what stats are the stats that are your favorite? What are your go-to numbers? What numbers matter? What numbers tend to be kind of noise and in the background? Talk to us a little bit about the stats that really speak to you when you're doing these things, or is it different for every pitcher?
Yeah. So the fun thing about what I do is I'm really lucky that I have a certain method that isn't often utilized the same way. I mean, there are some people that certainly do this. I mean, I learned it from Eno, essentially. But it's just, I don't often look at the high level numbers. Only in the off season can I honestly like quote the number of like what his ERA is what his WHIP is. Like, you'll hear me do the list in season, and I'll rank a guy something, and I see in the Twitch chat, dude, he has like a 405 ERA. He's like, oh, he does? Like, I don't care, you know? And I'm not even really that aware of it. I'm more aware of what is he throwing? How effective are those pitches? So the first thing I do is I look at every single club and I see who has the opportunities and who could actually be earning them. So that's the first step, regardless of how good you are or not. If you are the sixth guy in a rotation, maybe I'm going to just find out what you're like and maybe to see if you will get those opportunities and how you'll succeed in that. Then the next step is just, all right, what do you throw? And after 8 years, finally, I've created a site to help me answer those questions easier than ever, right? So you can just go into the repertoire section, and the main things that I find myself looking at are strike percentage, swing strike percentage, hard contact percentage. Those are the ones that I'm chasing the most at the moment. The other numbers, I mean, there are so many we offer here, are really nice at telling the story, making you understand how this is used. And you can even make assumptions, being like, oh, this pitch must have a lot of sink on it because you're seeing few fly balls on it, you're seeing high ground ball rates or whatever. Or maybe he's throwing it low, and then you can look at an approach and see high location versus low location. By the way, those are the two that matter most to me when it comes to the approach tab. It's not arm side location, glove side location, no. High lock versus low lock. They can really understand their plan of attack and is this working, is it not, all of that stuff. But once you understand strike percentage and really get a good grasp of what you're looking for, and fortunately we have the MLB averages on every table, so you can quickly grasp it. Then you can see, oh, he needs to throw more fastballs because the slider has a 51% strike rate. That's why Sonny Gray isn't able to throw more sliders. Because, you know, I was talking to Casey Bubba about this. It was a really good back and forth kind of talking about Sonny Gray, and we both dove in together and we both found, like, oh, right, 51% slider, strike rate on the slider, which is bad. That means that he can't consistently just throw it because he doesn't know if he's going to get a strike on this. I mean, if he knows it's a good count, like, sure, if I get a ball, fine. There's a time and place for it. And right. It limits hard contact a ton, but it's not a consistent pitch. It's not one of those in his repertoire that he can always rely on.
Yeah, so, it's a coin flip, basically, right?
That's so in many ways, CSW helps with this for us, but you also see like a high called strike rate on a curveball, and it's only a 55% strike rate. And generally, by the way, low 60s to mid 60s, like 63% is kind of like the average for this stuff. And if you see like 65% or 67, like, yeah, all right, this pitch is dependable. And you see like 57, you're like, oh no. So you might have a high CSW on that pitch, but it's because he gets a lot of called strikes. It's actually not something he just needs to throw more of. It's like, no, this is kind of hard for him to get them. But when it does, it works out really well. He's able to accept the ball that happens after, right? And thinking about it that way, those are the ones I go after. And then lastly, I mentioned swing strike rate and hard contact. Hard contact, like, is he getting destroyed by this or not? Like, right. That's pretty simple. Like, when he throws it, is it getting crushed? And like Wascarino Noah's fastball is a 40% hard contact rate. You got to fix that, Wascarino Noah. but swing strike rate on the other side of it is, okay, is this what he uses to get his strikeouts? For the most part, sometimes it's a called strike, two strike approach. You can actually even see inside of approach if he throws in two strikes, and if he has a high called strike rate and a high two strike rate, like, oh, I get it. It's kind of fun. But yeah, generally swing strike also outlines potential to me. If he gets like a 20% swing strike on something, like, oh man, it's only a 10% usage. Maybe that can go up. He still has a respectable 61% strike rate on it. Like, those are the kind of things that can sway one way or another, and give this idea of more to come, or is he capped out as he was? So that's generally my process. And there's a lot more to it. You know, these numbers tell a huge story, but if I'm just quickly trying to grasp what he's doing, got to see what he's throwing. And those major three are super, super helpful.
Which are the ones that are readily available that maybe don't tell the story, or at least not the story you're trying to find, that maybe you see people using a lot?
BABIP. BABIP is very much dependent on how good you are or not. And yes, there are a lot of times that you have a high BABIP, you go to a better team, and you're not going to have that bad of a defense. And you just got really unlucky one year. Absolutely. But I find myself not really touching it unless it's super egregious. Like last year's Eduardo Rodriguez is like 370 or something. Or you see, so I think it's John Means has like a 240 or something like that. Like, okay, like those should probably be close to each other, but I still expect E-Rod to have a much higher BABIP than I do John Means. Ground ball pitcher versus pitcher. We'll do that innately. But I don't talk about FIP, because honestly, FIP is just a derivative of strikeouts and walks and home runs. So if you just know those, then FIP doesn't really do much. I mean, you rarely will hear me talk about ERA and WHIP. Like, I care more about hit per nine or hard contact and walk rate themselves, you know? So that's kind of how I work.
You know, it's funny kind of like listening to a lot of different people talk about pitchers, because like, I want to know where the market is. It's kind of like one of the reasons I end up listening to podcasts. Like the difference between how I think WHIP gets mentioned and ERA gets mentioned is a really fascinating thing to me.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Like, no one cares about WHIP. It's the same value as ERA.
But it's not just that though. Also, it's like, I feel like people will never use WHIP to mention that a guy is bad. But I often will hear, and I think this is I don't know that it actually does mean it's guy is bad though. Do you know, like, this is a really weird tangent, but like WHIP is basically like on base percentage divided by not on base percentage. So it kind of curves as it goes up, which is a really weird thing. It's really slight.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know it's compounding is what you're saying for the most part.
Right, yeah. Right. The difference between a 1 and a 105 is not the same distance as a 1-2 and a 1-2-5. But, you know, it's like, I've listened to you and I've listened to other people talk about how, like, only a couple pitchers will ever be, like, a WHIP risk guy. and it's like Luis Castillo, and then the list basically stops after that or whatever it is.
Well, Marcus Stroman and Framber Valdez are ones that come to mind too.
And you know, those top line stats tell an interesting story, and I think a lot of the better time they get like used though is more like, I think that this combination of things gets us to this place. And whenever you end up with, yeah, but so-and-so had this last year, I often find that's a really fun starting point for like, how did that happen?
Right.
More so than anything else. And I think there's a lot of interesting kind of like, we can have that next conversation when someone has like a really outlier and weird FIP, actually, when you bring those up. So it's like a lot of the things people cite a lot, I'll see someone put it on Twitter, and more than it being like a declaration of so-and-so is good or bad, I take that to read as, I'm curious. This is weird. Because no one ever posts someone that's like, oh yeah, he had a 3.75 ERA. Like, that's just like, that's never going to be a piece of content.
Baldy, by the way, I'm pretty sure. It's either that or a 3.7, and I hate that I don't remember right now. Sorry.
Well, that I think might be the most impressive thing. I actually am kicking myself a little bit that we didn't start off by playing a game where I just throw out some random pitcher from a team and have you tell me like all the details of his splitter. It's amazing how much you have in your head.
By now there are the talking points for every guy. Like, enough, even in my own head, I've thought about these guys enough that it's just been reinforced. But Eovaldi, one of my talking points is like, Eovaldi apparently was just so amazing last year, yet it was still a very pedestrian ERA, like 3.7, 3.75. And to me, I don't think he gets better, and I don't really see how he really does much more than that. You know, obviously it could be like a 3.6 or something, like, fine. But it's not going to be demonstrably incredible. And I'm like, I'm not ready to settle for that. There's a chance it goes way farther over. So that's just why I know that one. I'm like, aha, Eovaldi, 3.75 guy. That's him.
Yeah, but you could do it for like the two guys battling for the fifth spot on X Team. You know, you can.
Oh, I love X Team. X Team is so underrated.
X Team's the best. It's fascinating. Dive a little bit before we kind of move into our next segment into the new player pages, and not as like an infomercial for them, but really because I'm just being flat out honest, as I've learned a lot about this sort of analysis by working with Alexander. Your formula worked, Nick, putting us together. I did learn a lot.
Yes.
And I'm starting
to
go
through. Good one.
And
all for you, not Chase, just you.
Well, he's the one who brought the knowledge. I just brought the questions. Is that as I'm now trying to do my own writing, referencing these new player pages really is incredibly helpful in the way that everything is organized. And one of the things that I think is super helpful is, as you said, how you can click on each individual pitch and see those statistics. So talk just a little bit about the design and the purpose and function of those. It could be the elevator pitch version. I just think that it's important for people to hear it as much as possible, because as soon as people go and use these things, I think they're going to be hooked.
I hope so. That's the idea. And by the way, it was a 3.75, and I'm very proud of myself right now. And that's how I'm going to go to bed tonight. I'm like, I got the Eovaldi ERA right. I got it. I mean, really, for me, y'all know, granular pitch data to me tells the story, as I've been saying. And the major thing that you should be able to take away with this is understanding how a pitcher does this thing, because honestly, it's the beauty of baseball. Every pitcher is given the same task, throw this ball into this imaginary box, yet every single one has a different way of doing it, and it's beautiful to me. And with these player pages, you have a ton of data. You have StatCast data. You have all the cool things you want with tooltips for every single one of them. You have things just, I don't know, location data. You have StatCast data. You have the CSW and home run fly ball rate and everything, and the WOBAs and hard contact and spin and movement. And it can be very overwhelming, and I'm sure it is for so many of you. And just, you can use the MLB average just tool that's just in the top right of every single table to understand, based on this pitch, what is the average O swing on a sinker, and it's 25%. So when I freak out about the 47% of Zach Wheeler's sinker O swing, you understand why, because that's insane. Right. That is so good.
That context being right there is so helpful. It just is. It gives you an idea of how far away from the league average things are.
Right.
Huge. Yeah.
It does a lot for me. I mean, I've learned a lot. I was like, oh yeah, strike percentage. I want to know more about that. And I understand that normally sinkers have a 65% strike rate, but Chris Bassett's now has a 71.5. And guess what? He actually has below average hard contact on that sinker. So that's really good. He gets more strikes to them and he isn't getting burned by them. Yeah. You know, you can innately come up with those narratives and understand the approaches. If you just kind of think of, you know, if you say it out loud, even all these things that he's doing better than league average and what's worse than league average, you can grasp what is good and what is bad without us saying like, this is a 5-star pitch, which I kind of want to do eventually. I think that's just such a cool idea, is you can just put a star of like 1 to 5 for every pitch and be like, hey guys, this is a 4.5-star pitch, according to us, you know, based on all this stuff. But that aside, there's just so much. And there's also the game log for in season. We are working on rolling charts right now. We have the design made and stuff. There's just a lot of things we want to get right first, but that is going to be this, through this year. And you can look at the game log. You see pitch mix changes with velocity changes as well. You can see, individual pitch metrics game by game now. And you can really dive into all that stuff and get more nuanced understanding of the flow of the season. So just mess around with it. And if you have any questions, just reach out to us at Pitcherless, of course, on Twitter. Reach out inside the Discord, whatever, because we want to share this. We want this to be your tool. We want this to be the thing that allows you to make your own nuanced decisions. You know, I try, but I am far from Nostradamus here. And I mean, was he even real though? Was he actually like that?
I don't know. Probably not. Like Shakespeare, but, was just a bunch of different people.
So maybe
people
I'm very similar to him. No, the whole point of these is to allow everybody else to find these things and have these discussions and have conversations about pitchers that is different than you normally have them.
Well, I think that's the part that I love the most is what we've been trying to do with this podcast is build capacity in people. And I think that these player pages give a lot of levels of access, so you can go to it, and if you don't want to do all the heavy lifting, you don't have to, and there's still a ton of useful information. And if you want to dig as deeply as you possibly can, you can do that too. So it's just the graphic interface. I don't know. It sounds like I'm shilling
it,
for you.
It but took a it while. Really... That took us 3 months of design, if you can believe it. Working.
No,
with
I totally
great
believe it.
Huge props to Quincy Dong. For nailing it with me and dealing with me in the process too. But no, Jimmy Barrett
Nick
helped a lot.
Notorious diva.
Greg Tebow and Mike Brooks as well helped out with the design, and initially from Riley Schoonover too. But yeah, Quincy Dong and I really nailing this at the end of the last summer, and I was just so excited. I couldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's really fun.
Alexander, what are your thoughts here before we move on to our next segment?
So, you know, in lieu of like, you know, actually listening to you guys for the last 25 minutes, all I've been doing is just scrolling up and down Freddy Peralta's player page because he was the first person who came to mind and I wanted to look at his player page.
Yeah, because he's number one in hard contact.
Probably is why it came to mind. So actually one of the things like if we can go off on a weird tangent is like, so I've been listening to you and Fast talk about a lot of guys who are kind of like farther down the list throughout the couple different 10 at a time on the corners. And I've been trying to wrap my head around how I think I would most want to talk about hard contact if we're just talking about a particular pitch. So I was like, okay, let's go to a guy that I've thought about. And like, I ended up not even looking into that one thing because like, you know, I had this one up just so I could have one to like go for earlier. And it's like, you know, like for example, for Peralta, yeah. I'm like looking at you brought up their approach. You're like, oh yeah, the high location versus low location. His high location went from 49% last year to 49% in 2020 to 31% in 2021.
You want to know why? Because he doesn't know where it's going. You know, that was a 2-month sample of 2020. Right? Freddy Peralta is nicknamed Professor Chaos for a reason.
I mean, you're not wrong, but it's like so far. Like he had been 47% in 2019, 38 in 2018, and then 31. I have no idea what high is for this, by the way. This is one where there isn't an MLB average, and I don't know that it would be helpful for some of these.
Oh, really? There isn't? There should be for this.
Oh, you know what? I'm just going to click it. Yep, there we go. Yep, there we go. I got it. So the high location average for Major League Baseball is 39%. So he was at or above that for his first 3 years in the bigs, and then like substantially below that. And that's really weird. And I'm really curious as to like how that just happened all the time.
You're even teaching me here because, right, you're using the approach table at the very bottom, which I don't even touch that much because that's across everything he throws. But I think, you know, if you're doing the Blake Snell blueprint, right, then if you're doing like fastballs up and breakers down, then it's split between the two. And maybe like he just has something. Yeah, changes. Let's say you throw 30% fastballs and 70% secondary stuff. Theoretically, you only have a 30% high lock, but then you have like a 90% four seam high lock, right?
Well, his four seam high lock is 31%.
It fell down. I'm seeing this now. Oh man, it's like normal high lock, but yeah, it went down like 20 points from 2020.
So that's interesting.
Sorry, I'm tangent.
Yeah. We're live learning. That's what we do here. What do you think would be the explanation? Is that representative of a decision, or is that just within the range of outcomes for somebody who throws the way that Peralta throws?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. It seems like, okay, so you think, oh, he threw a lot more lower or more often lower. And honestly, no. It looks to me as if the normal high pitches just went to Y-lock, which is YM-lock, which is just vertical middle, which is essentially think like belt high or something, which is not what you want. You never want any of the M locks. So YM lock or XM lock. No, that's the stuff you don't want.
It's the wheelhouse.
And that went up for Peralta last year to 33% from 22. So that stole a lot of the high lock away. And then there were some that were lower, but like you look at the strike zone plot itself on the right, and it looks like he's still trying to go up. He's just honestly sitting middle a ton, but his fast, I would take that from Peralta. Because it's just so stupid hard to hit.
Yeah.
And that's okay. 20% hard contact rate for on that four seamer is
so
wonderful.
He's living there and getting away with it.
Right. His zone rate went up. That's probably the big thing. He's not trying to nibble as much. He's just chucking it.
Yeah.
52% zone rate from 38.5.
The Robbie Ray model.
Yes. That's fine. That's fine when you have great stuff like Peralta does. I mean, he still, even despite that, had a near 10% walk rate. Why? Because the slider in all of its glory still had a low strike rate of 61%. Not that great for your secondary. You want 65 or so. So that's the issue with Peralta. And why I'm actually kind of out, despite the amazing hard contact. First in the majors among starters at 17.1%. I think he's going to regress a lot because of the walk rate. And because he doesn't know where things are going, it's just going to get kind of worse. I think he capped out last year.
I want to say, if I got to bring anything else out of this, it's just that I really like it when the thing that I expect to show up in a certain place shows up in that place, and I don't have to know where to find it by scrolling, but like, I can just remember that something is a batted ball stat and it shows up on the batted ball stat line or things like that. And the organization and like user friendliness of this is, I think, the most important thing.
I purposely repeated stats because I figured like you want to see it in Statcast, but you also want to see it in batted ball. And I was like, all right, well, let's just double it. Who cares?
Well, yeah, right. Absolutely. Because then you're looking in a different spot. You don't have to scroll up to compare the two.
Right.
The design is really, really intuitive and well thought out.
Oh, man. You guys
not that I
best.
Want to cut off the conversation where we wax ecstatic about these player pages as they deserve to be. But we are going to move into some more pitching conversation, picking more of Nick Pollock's brain. But before we get to that, we are going to take a very small break.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball, even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
And we are back. So, Nick, it is signing season. Baseball's back, first of all. Let's have a moment to celebrate that, right? We have opening day April 7th, not May 1st, not June 15th, right? Oh, not God. All, whatever the other possibilities were. We know when it's coming back. We can be excited. And there's been no shortage of activity and movement, whether it's trades or it is signings. And so what I wanted to kind of talk about here was, when pitchers move and there's a change of scenery, the kind of question we're trying to answer here is how do those changes either benefit or hurt pitchers in those situations? What is it that you're looking for somebody who like just moved to a different place, and maybe not even so much from like the fantasy angle, but the institutional angle. So we could just start with, we've got a list of questions here, and I'll just kind of start at the very top. Like, what are some success stories that we have from maybe the recent past that where somebody has kind of left an organization, landed somewhere else, and it's made a big difference?
So there are two that jump out, two groupings. One is leaving a bad organization. Mm-hmm. So that would be Joe Musgrove, Gerrit Cole are ones that we can quickly think of, all of a sudden going to these new scenarios and then being excellent out of the gate, right? Saying, bringing them into an organization or leaving one that really prevented them. Dylan Bundy going to Los Angeles or something. Oh, finally, he can throw a slider. And what do you know? He did well in that short sample before 2021, right? The other side of it is going into an excellent organization. So I think the most recent example is Kevin Gausman going to San Francisco. Now I've been saying a lot, like, I don't know how much I think they are excellent. I think it's just a smallish sample of guys, but whatever. Then there's Alex Wood, who also came in and increased his velocity like Gausman did. Descafani was still already good. He just had a bad 2020. So I'm not totally convinced on that one. But there's those examples too. And for the most part, I don't really put a ton of weight on guys shifting organizations inherently. I don't love really relying. It's like, oh no, he's on this team now. He's going to work with this pitching coach and everything's going to be great. I don't know. That's right. A really hard weight to put on. And I think we have so much data, so many different narratives and threads to pull on that's not the one that I'm going to go after. There's also Colton and the Wolf have a whole thing. Glenn Colton, Rick Wolf, about not getting guys after signing large contracts in the first year. And there is something to be said about that. So it makes me now like, oh no, why am I in on Robbie Ray and Kevin Gausman? But there is, I in a deal breaker or a tiebreaker situation, I will lean on that too, because I think there is something to be said about guys going a little bit, you know, pushing themselves a little bit and then finally being able to relax just a little bit in that first year.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like the focus is a little bit like, whatever, I'm set for 8 years or something. I get that mentally. But for the most part, when it comes to like changing organizations, okay, is it the Cardinals with their amazing defense? Is he going to Coors? Is he going to a bad situation? You know, that's really it. Otherwise, I just kind of expect them to be mostly the same. And the last thing I will say is there are situations where we see a tangible change in approach that could happen. Like I mentioned with Dylan Bundy, or we talked about with Joe Musgrove. And that gets me excited. Just get them out of that situation. So like Zach Wheeler for me, it was about getting him away from Wilson Ramos catching and the philosophies of the Mets, where they were putting their glove up YM lock, right? Like middle height. And I'm like, dude, what are you doing? That's not where you want to put this. And then emphasizing the slider more. And that's what happened in 2021 for Zach Wheeler, right? So there's stuff like that that will certainly get me to think a little bit more about it.
Alexander, you look like you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I do. So this is like a really
particular question, and this is something that's been on my mind a lot because of like the Rodon sort of like almost institutional transfer in my mind between the White Sox and the Giants. Ethan Katz is someone I feel like it made such a tangible and immediate difference in the outcomes of a whole lot of reclamation projects that just happened to all be on the roster because it seems like the previous mentality or approach or just lack of knowing how to keep shoulders separate or like attached to the rest of the body had kind of just created a lot of them. And I am maybe over just like ascribing things because I can, but like I have this sort of like weirdly developed mutual trust that both the Giants and, you know, Ethan Katz, who came from the Giants to the White Sox, can kind of do smart things for people who have a little bit different risk profile. So I'm curious, does that kind of like overlapping more success stories like mean anything to you in any sort of meaningful way?
It's hard because, I mean, you'll appreciate this. It's all a very small sample of success stories and failures, and then things change. And then we don't really ever get to a point where we can say, oh, this is good. We got this. You know, for everything we've been saying about the Astros, I mean, there's some success, and there is like, you know, okay, Luis Garcia did really well, but then second half or the end of the season fell off a bit, and the slider wasn't there, and the cutter was the only good thing, and so on and so forth. And they threw a slider to Jorge Soler. We all know how that went. And it's not always a success, right? And it's in some ways, I want to give more credit to the player than I do the coaching. And I don't really know when to, you know, when to give full credit to a coach or not. So when it's really apparent is when I'll actually say things. But right, it's, you know, it's not an easy thing to do.
Do you think it's, and this is just coming to the top of my head, so tell me if I'm being silly here. Do you think maybe it's more of a tale of a coach or an the institutional approach or the organizational approach of a team holding somebody back rather than being able to fix them?
Yeah, sometimes that's the issue, right? And that's, you know, right, there's the positive side and then there's the negative sides too.
Right.
I mean, as with everything in this world, we have to be nuanced.
Yeah.
And in a vacuum, which is a terrible phrase, but in a vacuum, don't worry about it. if you're getting overwhelmed by this, don't worry about it. You know, there's so many factors that can affect how well or poorly a pitcher performs in a year. And who knows how much the effect the team actually has.
One of the narratives that I see a lot when players switch, and maybe more so with hitters, but I think also with pitchers, is that people very quickly go to, okay, especially if it's a place like Cincinnati or Colorado, they immediately jump to these home road splits, and that's going to tell the story. And it drives me a little nuts, only because, so this came up with like Jesse Winker. So hitter, obviously.
Oh, yeah, but right.
The proof of concept, right? That now he's going to a place and is, it's not, what was it that Casey Bubba calls Cincinnati?
Grand American Small Park.
Yeah, there you go. It's so awesome.
Wonderful. I love it.
And so he's leaving a hitter's park, right? And so you're going to expect that that's going to have an impact, but to jump immediately to the road splits, I don't think is fair because there's so many more variables that go into playing on the road.
Oh yeah.
Whether that's comfort, where you're staying, the travel itself, being away from family, not being used to the nuance of the ballpark, the home crowd, all of these factors, right? There's so many variables.
Yes.
So how can we maybe dissect that narrative and find what makes more sense? What's the most likely outcome? Maybe it's not going to, so for Winker, it's not going to be that he's as prolific a hitter, maybe. Maybe it's going to switch a little bit. He's going to wind up getting more singles or doubles out of it as opposed to home runs.
I got the answer for you.
Right?
I've got it.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. So I'll stop with the premise and we'll just get right to the chase here.
In Arizona, I got to say, I'm incredibly lucky being able to go to First Pitch Arizona and be able to meet and hang out with all these great people in the industry. And one person I felt so lucky over the years to actually, you know, to get to hang out with and bond with is Derek Carty, a brilliant mind, of course, in it. And I was fortunate to be on a panel with him about streaming pitchers, because there's two different guys here. We got Derek Carty, who's got the bad X, which is like the greatest thing ever. And you got this schlub over here, yeah. who's just like, I'm going by feel every single day. What do I know? And so we're both talking about this stuff. And I sat there and I said to Carty, like, Carty, tell me right now. I absolutely hate home road splits and they're just noise. And he's like, yes, home road splits are dumb. And I said to him right there, is like, Carty, can you do me a huge favor while we're live on this panel? Can you tweet out that home road splits are dumb? And he did that. And it made me so happy. Now, the point he wanted to make after, which is very important, is that park factors are not dumb. But right. innately being on the road versus at home is stupid. That's just random grouping. If you're taking 10 starts, this guy threw, he threw five here, five there, just happened to be that they're going to be different. It's very rare for it to actually just be even in every single performance. And it drives right. me nuts. But we got to acknowledge that Jesse Winker pitched in that, hit in that park. I always say pitch. It's weird for me to say hit.
That's okay.
He hit in that park. And that will help him. It will not help him having half his games in Safeco. It's right. not about the home road splits. It's about the home field park factor.
But even like his previous performance in Safeco as a visiting player,
I don't know.
Again, maybe, and again, it's small sample sizes probably, yeah. but it just doesn't seem like it's the same thing. What, right. What was the weather like? What yeah. did the plane get in late? Right.
I mean, was his all wife of these there? Things.
Yeah, right.
You know what? The fun part of that is also like the Mariners have always had like a ton of lefties. So Winker would have just probably been rather trash, relatively speaking, if he'd actually had any at bats. Yeah. I know Winker is a guy that Carty in particular was like really vocal on like how the changes in the projections worked. And I actually checked out how things changed for him in particular league, because he got traded, and the same day he got traded in this particular league. So I was interested to see what had happened to his value. He was a guy that in this particular format, because he was projected at this point to like have an OBP that was like 380, and he was like looking at 33 home runs and like 90-90. Like, that is a guy that I drafted in a couple places in the past couple weeks, thinking he was like a top 50 player almost.
Right.
And then things shot down. He lost like 15 runs in RBI each and like 7 home runs and like 10 points off his OBP and batting average.
Yeah,
and 15 points off his batting average. And he was like, he went from like a $30 player in this league to 13. And that's just insane. Now, I think maybe the first time I'd run it was... I think I'd done some inflation because of age and the fact he's a hitter, not a pitcher, but like still, I think he moved from somewhere in the range of $23 to $25 projection to a $13 projection. That's like the moving from being a guy that is being severely undervalued at pick like 110 to a guy that is like a hard avoid and probably deserves to fall around to 130 or so at least. And, you know, that's based off of some specific information that's really easily publicly accessible. We know what the park factors for home runs in particular look like for Cincinnati, and we know what they look like for Seattle. And we're talking like a 20% better than average to like a 10% worse than average. Like, that's based off of a huge, huge number of like home runs that have been hit in these parks. On the other hand, you have like the misadventuring of trying to pick out the difference between like, I remember, Andrew Perpetua and I were taking some very different approaches to figuring out what would happen to home runs for pitchers. And I was like, hey, I'm just going to go look at all of John Means' home runs. And he ended up doing the same thing with like a little bit better camera work. And I was like, yeah, as I think Perpetua he would have lost six. And like, we're talking about just so, so few like runs. Like,
right. And not mention, it's not, you know, the idea that Means is all of a sudden going to allow exactly the same pitches in the same context in the same places. It's like
right. Yeah, they're not going to change their approach to fit their new surroundings.
Right.
Like all of these things, right?
Yeah.
They're all factors.
Just let it go, guys. Let it take it in and just push it. Just push it out. You know, just push it out.
I think the big difference there is like, if you're like, oh yeah, these six home runs wouldn't have been out, that's one thing. But on the other hand, if you're like, yeah, our math says that based off of all of the math, all of the home runs that have left the park or that haven't, we think that righty pull extreme guys might lose as much as 40% of their home runs. Like, that's based of a very different way of looking at things. And they can feel the same at some point, but it's just like it's the mountain of baseballs versus six.
I think that's right, also right.
Like that also got me thinking. It's like, you know what the difference between like a 3.3 ERA and a 4 ERA is in terms of earned runs over the course of a season?
What, like 5.8 or something? It's insane.
So, for example, I pulled this up earlier for Eovaldi. You know, his 3.75 over, what is it? I'll get you the exact number.
Wait, what
his
was the 3.75
over 1.82. Yes. Callback. 76 earned runs.
76. So, okay.
That actually divides super evenly and is really nice. He would have had a 3.5 ERA then, if I'm doing my math right. If he had, how am I doing to subtract there?
Oh yeah, it's like God. 10 or something, right?
Yeah, like it's if not five even. Earned runs would get him to a 3.5.
That's so it.
It's like
one home run. You know, I mean, obviously, one home run is five earned runs. That's funny, Nick.
Or but, one bad day, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, You could really go out there and have a stinker on a given day, and that is having this huge effect. That's what anytime you're talking about averages, right? They're pulled in directions by outliers, and that's one of the reasons that they can lie to you.
I think what this does a good job informing me whenever I get into those weird weeds is then when you start moving one guy's protection from one park to another and seeing how that affects the way that we draft them. If you're like in the really like script-y, projection calculator-y mindset,
right.
Is that the margins between one projection or another are so small that the perceived value between them gets really exaggerated beyond what we can actually like feel good about.
This is why
Nile looks like a $25 player based off of a 3.8 ERA projection. He's probably going to be somewhere a 3.8 ERA if he's in Oakland, but he's got like no ceiling better than that, right?
Well, that's the thing, is I think this gets lost a lot, and I've been trying to there was one day I'm ranting in my kitchen and I have it perfectly articulated. I'm like, I've got it. And I haven't been able to do it since. it's this idea.
Always
that,
record yourself. Just walk around recording of your thoughts all the time.
There aren't enough terabytes for it. there's an idea. If you have a mentality of grouping starters effectively, I'm going to try and fail probably as I replicate this. Where instead of trying to debate, okay, Lance Lynn or Lucas Giolito, you know, you just kind of group them together enough. And I mean in a tier of understanding, hey, this is a guy that's not going to fail me and has the ability to give me an SP1 season or something, right? Has like, you know, if it won't be crazy if I told you at the end of the year that Lucas Giolito, oh, he's number five or something because he just had a really good year. He pitched to a 3 ERA and was like, this was great. Right. And
because then he took off that one day in Boston.
Yeah. Right. No, because the 11:30 start time, because of the Boston Marathon. And that actually started a whole 4 week spur for him, I remember. And then everything else was incredible for Lucas Giolito. But what I'm getting at is that actually extends off past the teens. You know, there are a lot of guys in the 20s that, hey, if Charlie Morton isn't unhealthy, like, he's great, you know, it's fine. You could even see a world where Shane McClanahan throws like a 2.7 or something. I'm not saying he's going to, but my point is once you start thinking of players in the scope of their capabilities and like what actually is the realm of possibility at the top end. And then you have the other ones. Like, yeah, sure, there's always kind of some guys have a larger floor or something. Sure, fine. But then as you keep going in your draft, eventually you get to a point where that possibility is gone. And that is, you know, you are not drafting anybody with any expectation of seriously pushing the needle. And that is where I start saying, I don't care about those guys. Like, I don't want to draft that. Because my whole philosophy, as you guys know, is to craft in season the best pitching staff in the league. And I think you can if you pay attention and if you try to do it. All you need to do, just read the SP Roundup. I gotcha. So, because I've done that for 8 years, I've done the SP Roundup. Right. I've been able to witness this. And that's my mentality a lot and why I'm able to feel it out. Because, yeah, as you're saying, Chase, like trying to split hairs about, oh, he's projected for a 3.6 and this guy's projected for a 3.5.2. It's like, what? Like, we have no idea.
So this guy's better.
Right. No, you got to grasp, like, are they all going to be around the same abilities of what they can soar to be? And are they going to be pitching 5 days, you know, every 5 days or so? And like, great, you know, that's all you need to do. And this is why I was in on Sandy Alcantara and Zach Wheeler last year, is because they were able to do this in such a great position of throwing a ton of innings where they had the realm of possibility of being an SP1. But we never, right. I couldn't say that. I couldn't say, like, I think Sandy Alcantara is going to be an SP1. I didn't. But every way we talked about them, we're in this way of, oh, he's
was
destined
a non-zero chance.
Yeah, he's destined to be an SP3 or 4. And that's just, no, that's not true. You know, like, there is that opportunity for him to do that. But I can't talk about that, right?
Maybe Alexander, do you or Nick know the answer to this? When those projections are made, do we have any idea what the confidence intervals are on those projections?
Sometimes we do have variability things assigned. I know ATC does that a bit, but even so, that's still like not enough information to me. And this
Akota
is why I'm hooked
that as well.
It's why I'm hooked to just understanding what they throw. If you know what they have,
right. There you
and
go.
You know what they, you know what's a good fastball, you know what a good slider is, then just look at this and see, like, okay, for him to be an SP1, something needs to change and improve or so, and like, how far away is that? And that's how I work. That is my whole thing, and I've gotten into many arguments with people being like, he is this and he is that. I'm like, I don't know what he is, but I'm gonna lean more on that ceiling because I think
I
that's
wonder
just more
if there's
important
like a space for a like a player, like on a player page, let's say. And again, you guys tell me if I'm nuts. I'm coming up with this on the fly, where we have the projection as kind of like the middle of the graph, and then the range of outcomes at different interval confidence
right.
intervals.
So that does exist.
That totally exists. But like,
then you can see.
It doesn't quite achieve what I want to achieve, though.
Sure. I'm just curious, like, if you were to see that, though, and you're trying to compare two players, it might give you a better idea of the risk or the possible range of outcomes that a player might have.
Yeah.
I mean, I
the
don't know.
The hard part is putting a percentage on if.
Of course.
You know, and that's the thing that I want to highlight more is, like, what are the ifs, and then trying to figure out how to establish, like, hey, this is an if, and this is a possible if, or this is like a silly if. Like, I'm not just going to tell you, oh, Dylan Cease is going to have great curveball command this year. Like, that's an if that, like, guys, like, no.
No.
Yeah. Remains to be seen.
There are some ifs, and I think this is a weird thing that, and again, just I love to stare at player pages. And this time, one of the things I kind of found relating back to like the second year for guys. And Zach Wheeler, and you claiming this great Zach Wheeler success. You know, he, like, was way worse last year in terms of all of the things that I would care about, and I didn't understand why you were possibly in. So, like, let's look at his Mets years really quick, because I just think this is a great encapsulation.
Yeah, go ahead.
Of a dude moves, and I have no idea how that's going to change things. He was, like, basically somewhere between 23% strikeout rate, basically.
Oh, yeah,
entire
right,
time
right.
There. Yep. Like, he was who he was. And the walk rates were, like, close to 9 in a lot of these years. Like, they ticked down the last year, but like, it wasn't great. He goes to Philly in the short season. He has an 18.4% walk rate, and that is absolutely off my board strikeout rate personally.
Oh yeah, you said walk rate. Okay, yeah, you're talking
strikeout,
strikeout
rate.
Okay,
no,
yeah.
18% strikeout rate.
That sounds like a strikeout rate. Okay,
yeah. I want to note here another thing though. He'd been like a 20% slider guy. He went down to 15-16% the short season.
It drove me
and
nuts.
And then 25% last year.
It drove me
crazy. I don't
know
how you can claim that he was going to break out, and I still don't
get it. Okay,
I don't understand how you saw this coming at all.
Well, this is a very important distinction. I didn't claim he was going to, but the possibility was still very much there. And that's the point I'm trying to make is, you know, I've been shouting for Wheeler to throw more sliders for ages. His fastball, I mean, swing on the sinker was ages.
Also,
that was really cool to have too. Well, I mean, his four seamer went up 0.5. I don't actually see the velo jump as much. But I might have been on the slider or something like that. Yeah, the
I'm
slider
from
velocity,
like early Mets days. 2019, it was like the same as 2020. Yeah,
I got you. Okay. But more of the approach of Zach Wheeler speaks to just being efficient. And what I mean by that is amazingly well commanded high velocity heaters. If you can do that well, which is what is Zach Wheeler's bread and butter, you are giving yourself a foundation that all you need is a tweak in a breaking ball somewhere and strikeouts galore. It's like it's there for you. And that's exactly what happened to Sandy Alcantara in the second half last year. Like he's for the season, it's a 24%. And everyone's like, I don't know if I trust Sandy Alcantara and his lowish CSW and low strikeout rate. But then you see like the breakout happened when he went up to a 31% slider usage instead of a changeup, right? He flipped those over. And then all of a sudden he had a 30% strikeout rate in the last 2 months of the year. And that's what it is. So having like there's steps you need to achieve to be able to break out. And for those guys, it was just extra usage left on a breaking ball or maybe getting a little bit more feel and developing that, which is, of course, always an if. But that's what we're talking about. How strong are those ifs? What are the major gaps for it? And having such a good fastball that's well commanded and hard to hit. I mean, I will say, I understand 2020 Zach Wheeler, 32% hard contact on the four seamer. 2019, it was 20% in the larger sample. And it was down to 18.5% in 2021. Sinker also fell dramatically
2020,
too.
2020, who knows what guys' right. approaches were, where their
and
heads
I remember,
were.
I remember laughing. Right. I remember someone asked, like, aren't you worried about the strikeout? I was like, strikeouts, whatever. That's not how you say the thing. But I was like, yeah, that's a silly season. You know, a lot of things were weird in 2020. And I was like, no, give me a full season with Real Muto and the Phillies and all of that. And voila, we got it.
You know, it's really interesting. You say strikeouts or a fastball that does good things and the ability to maybe
Brandon
throw
Woodruff,
some more. What I'm thinking, though, is like as I stare at this page, though, we've not touched because we've been having too much fun of all the guys who could or might be shifted
around. Yeah,
you're talking
about Chris Bassett now, aren't you?
I am talking about Chris Bassett. Yeah, I am. Yeah. I'm really curious, though. Like, he's the guy I want to talk about because, you know, it's fun and he's old, but he's new and it's but like I'm curious though, like which guys who have had even just whispers around moving around, do you have any inclination to beg a new pitching coach to do some fun things with?
Right. So Chris Bassett to me doesn't have the same foundation of someone like Wheeler or Alcantara where it's 92-93 on the fastball. And because of that, the O swing isn't nearly as high. 24% O swing on the sinker. As opposed to the 47% or whatever, something stupid that it is with Wheeler, upper 30s for Alcantara. And it makes perfect sense. You can't tell that this thing is going to be off the plate when it's so, so hard. Well, it's a little bit easier to understand the trajectory at 92, 93. Still really hard. It's like, you know, sit in a box and take 92, 93 or whatever, and then take 98. Like, it's going to be different, but like, it's still stupid hard to hit.
Sure.
And with Bassett, I don't know if I see the same possibility in the secondaries that, you know, that we saw from both Alcantara and Wheeler. It's more of a cutter when it comes to the slider for Bassett. Changeup, slider, curveball are all like maybe the slider. I mean, Fast was mentioning that last year, like, no, he started to use the slider a little bit better. And maybe that is a thing. Maybe, you know, at 10% usage last year, maybe that does turn to 20%. And maybe I'm being really stupid about this, where he was using that more as a strikeout pitch. And if that goes up, which it could in New York, it's just a question of how good the slider and the sinker and four-seamer are. Four-seamer is a really good whiff pitch, by the way, 15 to 16% swing strike rates on it. I'm actually finding myself like more in on Bassett than I ever was before days. I had him like a 43 or something. I currently have him, I think, like 35, something like that.
That feels right. That feels really right to me.
I know. I feel so bad that I haven't updated my rank since February 8th, but the timing is weird because it's fine. I'm doing it in a week and a half.
There's a lot more dust to settle anyway, right?
Hey.
You go do a whole revamping and then 10 more things
exactly.
are going to change.
So yeah, I will say, if you want to hear my stuff on the top 100 update, I put out a full 25-minute plus pitch podcast for PL Plus users. So go check that out. And hey, you support this
wonderful
company. Become
a PL Plus member. Absolutely.
Yeah, go and do that.
So there's one more segment I want to get to. We might run a little long on this one.
What? Get out of here.
But the pass fail segment, this is relatively recent news. We're recording Wednesday, so you're hearing this on Friday. It's not quite as recent for you, but Chris Sale, not some not so great information, so it's a little bit of a stretch to put in our pass fail segment, but I want to get your quick feedback on Chris Sale in 2022, and then use that as like a springboard for how do you rank and evaluate pitchers with known injuries or coming off of injured seasons.
Okay, so this is like the toughest thing that I do. My least favorite part of preseason discussion is trying to project innings pitched. It sucks. Yeah. It just there's no winning with this. The thing I want to listen to the most is everyone that says, hey, just don't draft a starter that has any sort of injury question, like at all. Just knock them out completely and you'll be happier. And I feel like every single spring I say that to myself, like next year, Nick, you're going to do it. But then I see Clevinger and Severino come back. And when I talk about SP1 possibilities, considering how late they are going, there are a few other guys that can do that. So fine, I will do it at that point.
Now, which range of outcomes, right? Is what kind of what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Before.
Right. But there's a difference of doing that around pick 200 and doing it around pick 70 or so. Right. So I've been kind of dismissing Jack Flaherty's, and all of a sudden it's still a problem, even though he was pitching and wasn't. So I'm off that boat. I'm not off of the Gallen and Wheeler ones because they've pitched. And it was just kind of like, yeah, all right. I was just a little sore starting up again. There are different degrees of it. Chris Sale. Yeah, I'm out. I'm good.
Yeah, well, now he's it's a rib fracture, right?
It's a stress fracture in his rib cage.
Okay.
The number of words there almost makes it sound worse.
Yeah, right. It sounds like my first album. Rib cage stress fracture. But with
which
Sale,
one's the band name and which one's the album name?
Oh, that's I would definitely be Stress Fracture.
There we go.
Okay. That's totally me.
Debut album Ribcage.
And it's me like holding bones. For Chris Sale, I was actually already dropping him in my rankings a little bit because I find myself not too enthused about what we saw over those 9 starts. Velocity was still not back. The changeup got hit a lot harder than was elevated more often than it usually is. The slider wasn't so overwhelming. It just felt like worse Chris Sale. And I don't like that it's worse Chris Sale. So
he also throws stuff that gets hurt more by bad velo, right? I know that some pitches aren't hurt as bad, but I think I've seen some stuff come out recently on this.
Well, that's interesting.
I think that what it was is that I think it was Rudy Gamble who basically said, hey, y'all, I have an idea if someone wants to just do the work.
Velocity vulnerability index. Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah. The main thing about that that Carlos Mercado mentioned was something that is ringing in my head still from Eno being like, oh, yeah, fastballs in the 91 to 94 mile per hour range are all the same. And they're all that's bad. That's the bad range. Mm-hmm. But once you get to 95 is when it matters. Right. Mm. So like Wheeler. You know, and it's always very fascinating. I fall to this a lot. I fall prey to this where if I just have a standard for a pitcher, hey, you throw 91. Now you throw 92. Oh my God, he's throwing a tick harder, you know, and I get excited about that. And sometimes we do see like Bumgarner going from 90 to 92 was a huge difference last year. And in many ways for me, and maybe it is the right thing, I don't know. Is look, this guy is a major leaguer with all of this. He has hit the standard of being a good enough pitcher to deserve this. And now he's getting better, right? And I think a lot of those models are around this whole, like, what is the average thing? And the average thing does this. So that means that, like, the slightly below average of that is bad. But when you think about it as a pitcher, like, we talk about Sean Manaea. He was throwing 90 for a while, and then he was throwing 92 and had a lot of success. And we can correlate when he did well versus not well, but that's inside that 91 to 94 range, right?
Right.
So yeah. that's kind of how I think about it. And, you know, I part of me thinks it's just
the only
trap.
Factor, though, right?
Oh, absolutely not.
But
it does,
and all that
it
stuff.
Does improve a lot of things. And generally, when you see more velocity, you generally do see more ride or spin along the way too, because they're just throwing harder.
But if let's say you not only increased 2 ticks from 90 to 92, but you also increased your spin rate at the same time,
right?
that it might.
Yeah. Well, yeah. How's
those two things together? Right.
I've been taught this. That's not now. I got a thrashing from Fast. Like, Nick, it's not about spin. It's about active spin.
Okay, so active spin. We don't want to upset.
If it's good active spin, then like everything's good. The actual
I'm
spin
just saying
not, it, yeah.
whether but that's I, the actual thing or not. Maybe it's not just the one thing that's changed. It's that has changed in combination with something else that just makes it harder to see, or it's tunneled better, or whatever the case may be that makes it more deceptive. Oh. And you're adding the two ticks
right.
rather than it's just this
yeah,
is the exact same
point.
Pitch that's 2 miles an hour faster.
Yeah, it could be that.
Let's even play the fast angle. Maybe you just are more confident in it because you know you've got a little bit more velo on it, or maybe
look,
you
I'm
just
telling you,
command
man.
It better because like
fast,
it's used to what you're throwing rather than being weaker than what
and
you're
that's
throwing.
What the Vargas rule is, guys, is confidence in the zone, feeling good like in the zone mentally, not actually in the heart of the zone. That's like the opposite of the Vargas rule.
Yeah.
And actually, in many ways I could define a Vargas rule by just being good at avoiding mistakes in the middle of the plate. Like that's just at the heart of what is going on is not being in the heart.
Yeah. Okay. Before we get you out of here, I have an intrusive thought that I have to throw at you,
wow.
which is based off of
brace yourself.
Kind of like
a
last
winter is coming, Nick.
Okay. Here's how this goes. And just tell me to stop talking whenever you want. Luis Castillo, Dodgers sweeper. Could it work?
Dodger sweeper, as in like a sweepstakes? Like
no, the sweeper slider that they keep teaching everyone to throw.
Oh, wow. Probably not.
Okay. I don't know
I mean, the way I say
this,
that, no, here's the thing. That
was a huge
like,
buildup to...
Oh, I was like, Dodger
we need a different payoff here. Make this
Look,
make
also,
this
I'll put it this way. The Luis Castillo has tried to find a breaking ball for like 6 years. Mm-hmm. The Marlins tried to teach him, move him to a curveball. I remember suggesting it in one roundup or something, being like, huh, like based on like velocity bands and stuff, I would actually think he can go like the whole Yoan Santana approach or something. And then someone was commented to him like, oh yeah, Miami actually was trying to do that. And he was like, nah, I can't do this. And then he goes to Cincinnati and they're like, yeah, we want the changeup more than the slider that you're working on. And they've tried like multiple things with that slider. And I think he just kind of is what he is right now.
Mm. I mean, this is mostly, again, me just being like, I want to put together all of the ridiculous things here.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, say some dumb things for content. I don't want to say
no,
dumb
it's not dumb
content.
Whatsoever.
But, you I know, mean, you bring up guys who throw hard and maybe you're a tweak away because they have something. I don't know. If
I think it's his release that messes him up.
Yeah, that's the one missing thing.
But it's weird. I mean, again, it goes back to the humanity of the game that makes me so happy is like all of these guys have different skills. They're good at certain things. You know, you can't just take one thing from one person and give it to the next. Sometimes that works. Sometimes like, you know, you hear like, oh, this is how I throw my slider or something. And it works for this guy. It doesn't work for that guy. But everyone is skilled at different things and they have different feel for all of it. And it makes this whole game so, so fun to
right.
watch.
Like, okay, I'm going to relate this to something that seems unrelatable or unrelated, I should say.
I believe
second,
in you.
But I like to play golf, but what I do is really not super golfing per se. But I'll go out there and I am the same person and I'll put a swing on a ball and it'll be ideal. It'll be exactly what I was trying to do and try and execute. And the next time I'm in that situation, I am the same person and it does not go the same way. Now, I'm certainly not a professional golfer, but I also have to imagine that at that level, you're not talking about huge swings between peak performance and off-peak performance.
Right.
So the idea that somebody like Luis Castillo can be amazing and also maybe not quite so doesn't seem all that shocking when you think about him as a person throwing a baseball and not a machine who's doing the exact same thing every single time. It just feels to me like he's probably so close to doing it the same way, but the margins are like razor thin at that level. You can't get away with any kind of a mistake.
I implore everybody listening to just sit down and like chart a game, just one game, just watch it and just realize how many mistakes are thrown and how mm-hmm. often like a middling pitcher that you're thinking of just throws a bad one, you know, and it happens. A lot. Then you go and watch like prime Kershaw and it just never happens, you know? And that's why he yells, because it's so rare when Kershaw makes those mistakes, because it's just like, that's just not what I do. I'm not that guy. That's why he had a 170 ERA or whatever it was. It wasn't because his stuff was the filthiest of anyone. It was really filthy, but it's just he did the same things every single time.
Super repeatable.
And yeah. It's insane how much of a skill set that was for him.
Well, that is going to bring us to the end of our 50th episode. Alexander, we did it. Round of applause, sound effect, insert Woo. Here. Nick, thank you so much for being a part of this, for putting us together in the first place, for having the idea to put a network together, for taking a chance on people like me who had never done anything like this before,
Killing
and for joining
it.
Us tonight and talking pitching. It's so much fun.
Oh, man. We're all, I said it before, but we're all so lucky that you guys have done 50 episodes now. You're doing amazing work with this. I'm touched to be a part of it in any way. I shouldn't get any credit. Seriously, all I did was everyone's like, we want to do podcasts. Like, okay. YouTube, go and do it over here. I'm like, everyone's, oh my God, Nick did all of this.
It was
stuff.
More
like,
just
yes,
to get us to leave you alone so you could focus on.
Yeah,
on,
yeah right. Yeah. It was me giving you guys a video game. No, really, this is an awesome podcast, seriously. Thank you for so much for bringing me on. These were fun conversations. I know we didn't even like touch on half of this. And that's so fine
overplan.
With me, right?
That's,
like, it's just about
the
fun
come
talk.
Back.
There we go. I'm down.
Come back. Before we let you go, this is a silly, silly thing, because I don't think there's anybody who subscribes to this podcast that has no idea that. Where your stuff is. But just remind everybody where they can find and follow you.
Yes, it is at Dugout Study Hall Pod, I believe, on Twitter. Leave a 5-star rating and review. Make sure you do that. Well deserved and well needed for these guys. They should have hundreds and hundreds of stars and many reviews. If you haven't done it yet, why haven't you? Go ahead and do it right now.
Well, thank you very much. So now that Nick has not told people where they can find him. Alexander, can you go ahead and remind people where they can find us and, once again, the podcast?
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.